Today on the show, we're revealing my NBA awards ballot with Tom Haberstroh. And before that, we're going to talk about the latest on the NBA standings that's coming up right now. Today, we're revealing our NBA awards ballots, and we're going to talk about the games from Thursday night with the updated NBA standings with my friend, Tom Haberstroh. What up, Tom?
What's going on, KOC?
Let's get to Thursday before we reveal our awards, Tom, because the NBA standings continue to remain absolutely crazy after Minnesota beat Memphis on Thursday night, 141-125, a huge game by Anthony Edwards. He could not be stopped. Zach Edey got shredded, got into foul trouble early. Anthony Edwards, another great game for him. 13 of 19 from the field, 44 points in the game for Minnesota. And now for Minnesota, Tom, there's just a chance. They end up with the fourth seed if they finish this year 2-0 against the Nets and the Jazz. But they need a lot to go right. It's still early at this point, but there's a chance Minnesota could end up with the four seed.
Yeah, this is a crazy finish. The playoffs have already started. Like, as far as I'm concerned, Kev, like, the playoffs are already here. Because look at these standings. When you're talking about the Lakers, pretty much sealed the number three slot. Houston has number two. But basically, Denver can be anywhere from 3-8. Clippers can be anywhere from 4-8. The Warriors can be anywhere from 4-8. Memphis, Minnesota, all between 4-8. Like, basically nothing has been clinched yet in this big logjam here. See, Kev, like, you look at these standings with Minnesota at number 8, they actually might have the inside track at number 4, because if you look at it, the remaining schedule is against Brooklyn and Utah, both at home. And that's a godsend for them, because the other teams on this list, when you're looking at the standings, they're kind of playing against each other. They're going to be in this like Royal Rumble bloodbath against each other, whereas Minnesota can finish this easy breezy at 2-0 and end up with a home court advantage in the first round, even though they are at 8 right here. So going to the other teams, Memphis, they finish out the season at Denver against Dallas. Golden State at Portland against the Clippers. Clippers, they're at Sacramento and at Golden State. Denver, they play Memphis and then at Houston. Lakers, they play Houston and then at Portland to finish this out. So low-key, Portland has like two spoilers that they could play here to finish out the season. I can't wait to watch those. And then, Kev, the question becomes, Houston, do they want to play, you know, potentially the Memphis Grizzlies or the Denver Nuggets? And they can kind of decide how this plays out, because they're playing against Denver. They're hosting Denver in that final game. So if you're Ime Udoka and the Rockets, it's like, I can kind of decide.
You let Denver win that game. That's what I think. You let Denver win that game. You rest your guys, let Denver hopefully get the four seed, and you face whoever ends up in that seven slot. That's what I think. I don't think you want the chance of Jokic there. And also, by the way, I think Denver is going to win out this season. That's just my prediction. I think they're going to end up at four. I think they're going to beat Memphis on Friday night. I think they're going to beat a resting Houston team on the final day of the regular season, and they're going to clinch the four seed. That's my gut feeling there. I think so. I think for Minnesota and a lot of these teams, it's more of a fight for the five seed. That's my prediction. I could be dead wrong there. And that means that Clippers-Warriors game on the final day of the regular season could be the biggest bloodbath game, the biggest playoff-esque game of all of these ones we're talking about, because that could be the team that wins that game will be out of the play-in. And the team that loses that game might be the eighth seed, depending on how things shake out. Like, it could get absolutely nuts these final couple days of the regular season. So I'm, like you said, Tom, it's already the playoffs. It already is the playoffs. And it makes me even more excited for the West playoffs when we're seeing kind of the way these games are going this week, because every series is going to be good. It doesn't matter who gets matched up in the end.
Yeah, and also, I think there's going to be some gamesmanship on Sunday. Again, one of the things we talked about last week, about how when you're talking, the NBA has created like an all day, like the Sunday where every team is playing on Sunday. There's no games on Saturday. Every team plays on Sunday in two time slots. It's going to be awesome. I love this. It's going right up against the Masters. Who cares? It's going to be great. Any NBA fan, the Venn diagram of Masters fans and the NBA fans, I'm sorry if you got to pick and choose. I don't know if it's that much of an overlap, but I'll tell you this. It's going to be a lot of fun. I'm locked in for the Blazers broadcast on Sunday against the Lakers, and I'm curious to see what they do. You know, are they going to rest Luka and LeBron and try to get them some extra, you know, juice going into the postseason? Or are they trying to say, like, hey, we only have so many games with J.J. Redick, Luka, Austin Reeves, and LeBron. We got to get as many reps with these guys as possible.
Yes, exactly. And in the East, Indiana beat Cleveland on Thursday night. Another good win for them. They've won six in a row. They have a chance to get the three seed, depending on what happens with the Knicks. Currently, it's the Knicks, Pistons, Pacers, Bucks. Which matchup would you rather see there, Tom? You want Pacers to face the Bucks or Pacers to face the Pistons and vice versa with the other game, other teams?
There's no wrong answers here, but I'll go with Milwaukee against the Indiana. Just kind of a redux of what we had last year. And I think there's still some residual. Remember the Tyrese Halliburton weird tunnel story from a couple years back? Like, I do think there's a lot of kind of bad blood between these two teams. And so I would love Indiana, Milwaukee.
I'd be heavily in favor of that as well. And one other thing I want to talk about from this week, Tom, Jokic. They fire Michael Malone. They fire Calvin Booth, which we talked about earlier in the week on the podcast. And then they beat the Kings. And Jokic doesn't have nearly as many touches as he does normally in that game. The ball is, you know, being distributed even more than it already is. And then after the game, Jokic, microphone in his face, he says, "People say that we were vulnerable, but the beast is always the most dangerous when they're vulnerable." Maybe he woke up the beast. Do you think there's any chance that actually happened?
Man, I was kind of wondering if Jokic was standing behind the Kroenkes here, because Josh Kroenke making the call to fire both Mike Malone and say, Calvin Booth, pack your bags. And I was curious to see what kind of Jokic we'd see in this game. And you're right. The touches were way down. He was averaging about 105, 106 touches per game for the season. And in that game against against Sacramento, it was only 88. It was like 88 touches. So he was down like 20 touches in the game. His time of possession was down about 33%. And so part of me feels like that was very intentional. And maybe you read into it and say Jokic wanted less of scoring responsibility, less having to do everything offensively, having the energy to defend at a high level at the nail, basically in pick and rolls, being able to collapse and get back on rotations and defend the rim, because that was the biggest thing about Jokic's season. Why, in my book, teaser alert, I have Shea winning MVP, because defensively, Jokic has had a tough year, especially at the rim, where he's just red carpet, matador at the rim, because he just doesn't have the energy to be a rim protector. And so I'm reading this quote and I'm like, I'm wondering if Jokic is standing behind the decision to clean house. And based on this quote, it's very clear that he has a little bit more optimistic outlook on the season going forward, and that this was a change that maybe needed to happen. Because I kind of feel like, Kev, if he was against firing Michael Malone and Calvin Booth, I don't think he would have this vulnerable beast line. But he's kind of cribbing the quote from Josh Kroenke to make it seem like, wait a minute, I'm not saying Jokic was behind the whole firing, but it seems like he is supporting the decision by saying they might have woken up the beast.
You know, I think for Jokic, he said after the game also that, you know, he found out early before anybody else. Kroenke told him early. And, you know, that's true. I think you could be right that Jokic gave the, okay, yeah, that's fine. That, like, maybe Kroenke doesn't do it if Jokic is like, no, we cannot use Malone. But clearly Jokic accepted it. I don't think there was necessarily a lot of pushback. And that's because Jokic has won a championship and he's seen what it's like when the team is clicking on all cylinders. He's seen what it's like when chemistry is good and he's seen that dissolve. As I said on the podcast earlier in the week, people in that front office and on the coaching staff were walking on eggshells. Like, you could have a coach talking to a lower level front office member, and, you know, Booth or Malone would be in the corner like, what are they talking about? Is there people conspiring against me? Like what's going on? There wasn't any trust between the front office members and coaching staff members. And so I'm sure Jokic sees all that, and he's like, this isn't championship culture. And remember the quote he had about a month ago, or maybe a month and a half ago? They have their little winning streak, and then they lose a tough game. And he's like, well, maybe we're not as good as we thought we were. Like, he's been pretty honest and forward this season. And Malone said previously about a few weeks ago how I show the team film and they're like, coach, you're tripping. And nobody, like, he's basically saying, I've lost the locker room. Like, translation, I've lost the locker room. People are not listening to me. Jokic sees that too. Kroenke definitely saw that. I think it was the right decision, despite it being so late in the season, to fire Michael Malone. Adelman has always been their offensive coordinator. He's been in interviews to be a head coach, always been highly respected. I think it's worth the gamble here, considering the lack of chemistry that Malone and Booth had together. You can't have that lack of continuity, that lack of connectedness, I mean to say, between your front office and coaching staff and ownership. So it was the right move for Denver, as we talked about earlier in the week. Let's talk about awards, though. You mentioned that you have SGA over Jokic for MVP. Let's get to my MVP ballot first here. This is my ninth year with a ballot, and I'd say this is my toughest choice so far, because on one hand, you have Jokic having an all-time season. 30 points, 13 boards, 10 assists, absurd levels of efficiency. And the diversity of his offense is remarkable. Low and high posts, off-ball cuts. Became one of the NBA's best three-point shooters. Pick and pops, drives, handoffs, coming off screens, offensive boards. It's like elite, elite, elite when you look at the synergy data for all of those play types. He's just amazing. Everybody knows that. It's another all-time great season by one of the greatest offensive talents the league has ever seen. But he was not the same level defensively, in part because of this massive offensive load and responsibility he had. The Nuggets had a bottom 10 defensive rating, and Jokic is in part to blame for that as one of the five on defense. And you could say, well, you know, he's dragged them to almost 50 wins. Murray's had a down year. Gordon's missed 30 games. And this is all during a season where they fire their coach. They fire their GM. They haven't been getting along all year. There hasn't been any chemistry. The coach lost the locker room. They'd be in hell without Jokic. And that's a good argument for him as the MVP. However, you need to look at the other side of this here, of course, because there's SGA. By far the best player on by far the best team, 33-5-4 on incredible efficiency for a guard. Of the players historically to average over 32 points, over 5 assists, over 60% true shooting, and plus over 2 steals and blocks combined per game. Michael Jordan did it twice. Jordan did it 3 times. Harden did it twice. And none of those teams by Jordan or Harden had won over 55 games. And that's in part because of SGA. They have 66 wins right now with a chance to get to 68, despite Chet playing just over 30 games, despite Hartenstein playing under 60 games. The Thunder had a plus 26.7 net rating in minutes without Chet Holmgren, without Isaiah Hartenstein, and without Jalen Williams. So even without their second best player and their two bigs, they pushed for nearly 70 wins with SGA. They were dominant without those other guys on the floor, with only SGA out there. They were incredible with him. They were average without him. And that's partially because of his defense. Jokic, the defense has fallen off this year, but for SGA, he wasn't the weak link despite his massive offensive load. He was an excellent defender, a block per game, almost 2 steals per game, aggressiveness, awareness, communicated. He helped set a tone for that team. So I think the argument is incredibly strong for both. I wouldn't knock anybody for picking Jokic, but because one player dragged his team to 50 wins despite everything, and one player was the best player on the best team, both having awesome seasons. But my vote goes to SGA.
Me too. I mean, you just laid it out perfectly. The two-way play of Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is sealing the award for him in my book. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is one of the best shot blockers in the NBA. He's crazy. 21st. In the NBA in blocks. He's got more blocks this season than Giannis Antetokounmpo, Jared Allen, and Draymond Green. I'm going to repeat that. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who's a guard, who's the head of the snake offensively for them. He's leading the league in scoring. And he's got more blocks than Giannis, more blocks than Jared Allen, who's the 5'4", one of the best defenses in the NBA.
Huh?
And Draymond Green.
How's that possible?
You know why
Tom?
It's possible?
Crazy.
Because he's that talented. He's that talented. He's that well coached. Mark Daigneault, the way that he's employed and empowered Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, using this 6'6 dude, super strong, super smart, well disciplined, the way they play both ends of the floor, it's kind of a symbiotic relationship between he and the head coach. You look at Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, the consistency is outrageous. He's leading the league in scoring by a mile. But more importantly to me, he's had 72 straight games with at least 20 points. You know how crazy that is? That's more than anybody in the NBA. And it is fourth all time behind Wilt and Oscar. So Wilt has done it twice, where he's had 126 games of 20 plus. Wilt Chamberlain also did it again with 92. Oscar had 79. And then tied for fourth all time. As of this recording, he is tied for fourth all time at 72, tied with Kevin Durant and Michael Jordan. 72 straight games or 20 plus. He's top 21 in blocks. He's top 2 in steals. This guy is basically 50-40-90. If he wasn't, he has a 38% three-point shooting. There's an argument to be made for Nikola Jokic offensively as the best player on the planet. And I think he is the best offensive player on the planet. Right behind him, you can say Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. You can say Luka Doncic. But in terms of all-around game, no one checks off more boxes than Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. This is the best defense we've seen in a very long time, and he's a big part of it. You can't say the same for Jokic.
You know, I think that's spot on, Tom. I mean, look, I'm not going to fault anybody for picking SGA. I'm not going to fault anybody for picking Jokic. It's just, like, he's outstanding. He's unbelievable. The argument for him is strong, the way I laid that earlier. But everything you said, everything I said for SGA, it's not just picking the best player on the best team. It's picking a guy that leveled up his play even greater than he was last year when he finished second. And rightfully so. I thought he finished second. I thought it should have been second or third last year. I actually had him third. I had Luka second on my ballot last year. I had SGA third. So, like, he's way better this season than he was last season. Now, behind them on the ballot, I have SGA and Jokic. Let's bring my ballot up on the screen again. We have Giannis and Tatum in the third and fourth spot. I don't think that's necessarily anything people are going to be arguing over. That feels like pretty self-explanatory. The fifth spot, I have LeBron James, and he's my first team All-NBA, fifth on my MVP ballot as well. So LeBron at 5, 25-8-8 for stretches of the season, he's looked like an all-defensive player. I don't think it's a stretch to say that he belongs here on the fifth spot on my ballot. Earlier in the week, I had Danny Parkins from FS1 on my pod, and he also said, yeah, let's go with LeBron at the fifth spot. And I agree with that. What do you think, Tom? Is this fair to put LeBron at fifth?
I would have it between he, Stephen Curry. I have him in that conversation. I also, you know, Donovan Mitchell, the way that he kind of tailed off at the end of the season in Cleveland hasn't finished super strong. I think he had a chance to assert himself as that number five slot. But I understand it's going to be up for grabs, that five slot. LeBron has been a really consistent performer, whether it's pre-Luka Doncic, as the guy who was the face of the franchise with J.J. Redick taking over. LeBron's been there. And he, remember earlier in the season, he had one of his worst three-point shooting streaks of his entire career. And people were like, oh, he's done. Like, he can't shoot like he used to. His shot's broken. And then he rattled off one of the best, the hottest three-point shooting stretches of his career. And the fact that he is even in this conversation is crazy. It is crazy. And then you got Steph Curry, who's been all the way, like, offensively, one of the best players in the league, and a guy that has so much gravity still at this age, who's able to drop 50, able to drop 60 still in today's NBA. It's absurd. But I can't argue against LeBron James. Defensively, earlier in this season, he wasn't as sharp. But you know what? Everybody at that number five slot has a little bit of wart in their game, or a little bit of weaknesses that you can, you know, count against them. But LeBron James, man, the way the Lakers have maintained sanity throughout what is an outrageous season and completely buried the whole Bronny James controversy earlier in the season. No one's talking about that anymore. And that's part of the reason is because LeBron James has quieted all the critics and continued to play at an extremely high level. And that consistency counts for something. Number five, that it's 2025 and LeBron James could be the number five slot in the MVP race. That's insane.
Tom, and the listeners, I want to get your feedback on my all NBA teams right now. First team is the same as the top five for MVP with SGA, Jokic, Giannis, Tatum, and LeBron. Second team, I've got Mobley and Mitchell, two Cleveland Cavaliers there alongside Cade Cunningham, Jalen Brunson, and Anthony Edwards. And then on the third team, I've got Stephen Curry, Jaren Jackson, Karl Anthony Towns, Jalen Williams, and Ivica Zubac. Any issues, Tom, with my selections or the teams chosen with my three All-NBA teams? Any issues here? Probably Steph. I assume Steph is one of them.
Yeah, Steph would be second team for me over Jalen Brunson. And I do wonder, who are your toughest cuts here? So Ty Halliburton?
Halliburton was a very, very tough cut. He's been outstanding ever since the NBA Cup. I think with Halliburton, I still wish he scored more. I know it might sound silly, but I like there was a stat posted on X the other day where it's like he shoots like five times less per game when he just misses his first shot. And I thought that was really indicative of his style, where sometimes he's just too passive as a scorer. I think he needs to be in the playoffs for Indiana to truly be a finals threat. He needs to be, you know, 28, 29 point per game score, and I think he has that in him. So I'm not yet there with him as all NBA, but he was very, very close, a very tough cut because he's been part of a solid defense. He's been an outstanding playmaker, tough cut. Harden was a cut. Siakam, I considered him. Alperen Şengün from Houston, he was a really tough cut, probably the toughest of them all. Those are just a handful of the tough cuts from the third team.
I love Zubac, dude. I love Zubac. That is a bold pick to have him third team all NBA, but he deserves it. He might be the best defender this season in the NBA. We'll talk about this later. But the way that he's improved his game, he could win most improved player. I wouldn't knock that. He could be defensive player of the year because now that Victor Wembanyama's out, it kind of opens up to an entirely new race, and it's going to be very competitive. But Zubac has been outstanding and underrated and a guy that I think might be at this point the most underrated player in the NBA. His two-way play and the ability to, I mean, that Clippers defense has been top two basically the entire season. And once they get Kawhi and James Harden, Norm Powell's been in and out of the lineup, the constant is that dude Zubac. So I'm not knocking that. I like that pick. And it also, I think, is important to acknowledge that the Los Angeles Clippers have been so good this season. And it kind of gives a nod for one of the representatives to be on that team. It's interesting. You have basically three centers here in Karl Anthony Towns, Jaren Jackson Jr., and Zubac. And it reminds me that this NBA, it still is vastly important to have a really good five. And centers still matter at a high level. I can't knock your third team. I probably would have Şengün in there for Zubac, but it's a coin flip for a lot of these guys. And for Tyrese Halliburton, he's been good, but the consistency factor, he's been one of the highest variance players in the NBA. At home, on the road, it was like Jekyll and Hyde for much of this season. And that consistency is probably going to cost him some votes here. And I'm with you. This is going to be a very competitive race, but I got Şengün as the representative for the Houston Rockets in those three teams.
Very fair to have Şengün on there. He's been awesome this season. And I'll tell you what, I mean, I know this is a regular season award. I look forward to seeing how he performs in the postseason because, you know, I think with the Rockets, they've been great this year. We'll talk about Coach of the Year later. We'll talk about, you know, if they get any other awards as well. Amen Thompson, Defensive Player of the Year, All-D and all that too. But with Şengün specifically, he's borderline All-NBA this year. He might end up actually getting it once we see the ballots revealed later in the playoffs. But for Houston specifically, everybody talks about Jalen Green as the key to like the main area of improvement for the Rockets. But to me, it's how does Şengün perform in some of these high leverage games? Are teams trying to attack him? Do they do it successfully? Or does he continue to show that, hey, I'm not a defensive liability anymore? Does his lack of a reliable jumper become an issue for Houston? Because sometimes during the season, we know how their offense can get clunky in end game situations. So with Şengün, I look forward to seeing how he performs in this playoffs for Houston because regular season without a question. Dude was awesome, and he was my toughest cut. We'll do more awards right after this quick break. All right, Tom, let's talk about rookies. Who you got for Rookie of the Year?
Man, Reese Shea's making a chase for it, isn't it? Like that is really impressive what he's done lately in the scoring column. He's been balling out, but I got Steph Castle, Rookie of the Year. This guy has been performing as basically their playmaker down the stretch without Wemby, without De'Aaron Fox, and playing at a really high level. His shooting percentages, you would like to see them improve a little bit more based on his athleticism and based on his decision-making. You'd expect to be a little bit higher, but he's been so good down the stretch. As good as Reese Shea has been in the scoring column, I think Steph Castle has been the more complete player consistently from start to finish this season, and Castle's my pick.
I'm right there with you. It's close between Castle and Reese Shea, because Reese Shea, awesome close to the season, but over the full year, 12.7 points per game. He's made 35.5% of his threes, closed the year well over 40%, 42.4% from three since January 30th. And you got to feel optimistic that, you know, hopefully he carries this into the future, even though he's been very streaky in the past. He's like, it's not just stand still, catch and shoot threes. He's coming off of screens. It's movement off the catch. He looks great. Castle, not as efficient as a scorer, but the difference is less significant than you'd think. Reese Shea, 55.7% true shooting. Castle, 52.1%. And Castle closed the gap, even though he wasn't as efficient from three-point range, because of his ability to create chances at the rim. He had triple the amount of unassisted shots at the rim, triple the amount of drawn fouls. Castle didn't shoot as well from three, only 28.3% from three, but he was far better as the creator, as a playmaker. He had 594 pick and rolls this year, 150 isolations. Reese Shea, only 83 pick and rolls, only 13 isolations. Both had huge scoring games. Reese Shea scored over 28 times, but Castle did it 20 times. And that's in part because Castle is a self-created player with a lot of his points. Reese Shea is scoring off of others a lot of the time. And that's no knock on Reese Shea. He's a great cutter. He is a great mover without the ball. He's very smart. He's a good connective passer. Right now, he looks like an elite shooter. But Castle, he had 34 games with at least five assists. Reese Shea had zero. And so offensively, to me, Castle's, as you argued, Tom, he just did more. And then defensively, I think both rookies were really good as rookie defenders. But if you look at against the Bucks, it's Reese Shea defending Kuzma, Castle's defending Dame. Against the Warriors, Reese Shea defends Moody, Castle defends Steph. Against the Grizzlies, Reese Shea defends Wells, Castle defends Ja Morant. And that's true for every team. B-Ball Index has this matchup difficulty stat that kind of accounts for, it's in the name, matchup difficulty. How tough is the matchup for the defensive player? It's in the name. And it uses data to pull from like the amount that the opponents are taking and puts them into percentiles. Reese Shea, his matchup difficulty is in the 49th percentile. Castle is in the 97th percentile. So I think that goes to show like the load he carried offensively, Tom, and the amount of tough matchups he handled on defense. And we saw he did a solid job against Steph and that shocking Spurs win over the Warriors this week. Castle, man, my Rookie of the Year as well. I'm with you.
Yeah, I think Castle wins it. I think Reese Shea gets a little bit of a bump for his late season play. And when you look at Jalen Wells and the fact that he was oftentimes the best wing defender for the Memphis Grizzlies and a guy that was such a rock for them with all of the controversy, with the changes mid-season, he was awesome. And it's really unfortunate that he had that really scary injury there on that play against Charlotte. And that was one of those things where, as a fan, you're heartbroken because no player should have to deal with that when they're going up for a dunk. And Simpson had a really heartfelt apology. I don't think it was a dirty play. It's just something that happens. And I think Mark Williams might have clipped him there, and it wasn't necessarily Simpson just being reckless there. But Jalen Wells, I think, had a very underrated rookie season. And I do think that he's along with Zach Edey, along with Donovan Clingan, along with Bouzelis, there were a lot of guys this rookie season that in the second half of the year, you could make the argument that they deserve Rookie of the Year over Stephen Castle and Reese Hoshea. But I think from start to finish, you look at Castle, I think he's been the better player. And going forward, Kev, are you, you know, sometimes rookie of the year is kind of like a redraft award where it's like he might have gone number one if we did a redraft right now. Are you most bold about his future compared to the rest of the rookie class? Because you have like Zach Edey was, I think, better than a lot of people expected. Donovan Klingon had like the best rebound rate for a rookie of all time. Wasn't able to stay on the floor as much because of the fouling. But there have been some really bright moments from this rookie class that started out as the worst rookie class. I wrote about it for Yahoo, the worst rookie class ever. But there were some nice moments down the stretch, especially for Modest Muzelis, who, man, that guy is super talented.
You know, I actually don't think I'd change my rankings too much. I'm pretty happy with what I had in 24. I had Shepherd 1. I'd stay with that. I had Klingon 2, Castle 3, Muzelis 4, Devin Carter 5. I'd maybe bump Devin Carter down because he's an upperclassman out of Providence, did not have a great year for Sacramento, but he also missed the start of the year with injury, so it wouldn't be a large drop for him. I had Saar at 6, and I had Edey at 7. So I'm pretty happy with my top 7 rankings. Maybe like I'd move Reese Hoshea up. I had him too low. I'd move McCain up. I had him at 12. I'm happy having him at 12, but I would move him up more. And, you know, so I think redrafting Reed, we didn't see a lot of Reed Shepherd this year, but every time we did for extended minutes, it felt like it was good, really good, sometimes awesome, including this week. So maybe we'll see it again this weekend if Houston's resting their stars and they have their young guys playing again. But I think I'd stick mostly with what I did for, you know, the 2024 draft originally in a redraft, except for a couple tweaks. Ultimately, though, Castle. Dude.
If Reed played for the Washington Wizards this year, he would have won Rookie of the Year. There's no doubt in my mind. No doubt.
I think he would have as well. Like, Matt, if he got everything Bob Carrington did, he wins Rookie of the Year.
Yeah, I think anytime he got oxygen, anytime he got playing time, if he played for Charlotte, if he played for Washington, if he played for a team that needed a point guard or someone to absorb that kind of offensive scoring and distributing responsibility, like he would win. And because he's on a team, the Houston Rockets, that are trying to win a championship this year, I understand why people would be out on Reed Shepherd and saying, like, look, they got a number 3 pick who barely played this season. We're still on that bandwagon, dude. Like, I am still on Reed Shepherd Island.
Let's pull up my first team all rookie. He is not here. He's not on any of the teams. I have Wells as in third for Rookie of the Year, Edey and Kalel Ware rounding out the first team. I feel like with Kalel Ware, he's been excellent this year for the Miami Heat, which has not been a great year for them, but he's been very impressive. And then on the second team, I have Alex Saar, Donovan Klingon, Missy, Muzelis, and Kyle Filipowski. This is tough, man, because there are a lot of candidates this year. You can, because games played don't matter, so you could consider Jared McCain, but you know he got injured so early in the year, I didn't pick him. Bob Carrington, Keyshawn George from Washington, Isaiah Collier from Utah has been really good to close the year. Ron Holland with his defense and just how steady he's been. Jamal Shedd, Justin Edwards. Like, there's a lot of guys you could consider for the second team, but this is what I ended up with for the all-rookie teams. And any standouts here? Are you mad that I had Klingon on the second team instead of the first team, Tom?
No, I'm not. And Filipowski, by the way, against Klingon, 30-18-5. The other night, like Filipowski showed out. Like that was a monster performance. And yeah, not many people are watching Utah Portland on a Wednesday night overtime game, but dude, Filipowski showed out. It was an incredible performance from him. 30-18-5. Not many rookies are putting up that. And look, when you're talking fighting for the second team slots on a down rookie season, I'm not going to hate it. I'm a guy who watched Filipowski you know, when Wake Forest beat them last year and then Filipowski had that whole like injury when we rushed the floor. I had a little bit of a sour taste on Filipowski and his stock going forward. Just wasn't the biggest fan of that guy. But college stuff aside, Filipowski was fantastic down the stretch here. And again, like, some of that is just playing time, is that he was able to get these touches, able to get these minutes down the stretch for a Utah team that wasn't necessarily trying to play every game to win. But that's what you need sometimes in order to get to these type of accolades.
I think that's fair, Tom. Let's move on to Defensive Player of the Year. I did a lot of research on this one this week, Tom. I'm picking Amen Thompson for Defensive Player of the Year. I'm doing it, man. I'm picking Amen Thompson. This year, I think he was the best defender in basketball. Granted, you know, Victor Wembanyama got injured halfway through. Less than 6 feet, on shots less than 6 feet from the basket, opponents shoot 9.7% worse when Amen Thompson is defending. Less than 10 feet, 9.5% worse. Greater than 15 feet, they shoot 5.5% worse. And that's because the dude is near the top of the league in block jumpers, altered shots. We've seen what he can do. Blocking SGA, contesting Stephen Curry, every foot around on the half court. 94th percentile on matchup difficulty, according to B-Ball Index. He always defends the opponent's best player. He's defending guards, Ja Morant, Donovan Mitchell, SGA, Curry. Bigger wings, Anthony Edwards, LeBron James. He's even defended guys like Evan Mobley and Naz Reid, bigs. And he does it at an elite level, all while being an elite help defender. He's not just an on-ball stopper guy. He's jumps the passing lanes. He's an interior shot blocker. He has amazing hands where, like, in transition, sometimes a guy will be rumbling down the court and he swipes the ball, knocks it out of bounds, or just rips it out of their hands entirely. He's a transition stopper as well. He's a great help defender. And I think if you just, like, isolate Amen in particular games, if you watch that Warriors-Rockets game, Amen was the more impactful defender than Draymond Green. You watch the OKC game, Amen was more impactful than Lou Dort. And I with Evan Mobley, I have him second on my ballot. I think Mobley is a deserving candidate, but I never watch him and feel that he is the NBA's best and most impactful defender. He's great. He's versatile. He's been part of a top 10 defense, but Cleveland slipping defensively is in part why he doesn't win this for me over Amen. But Tom, that's my case for Amen Thompson, first on my ballot. I have Dort third, for what it's worth. What do you think?
Yeah, dude. Amen Thompson's my pick too. I didn't think you were going to go there. I have Amen. You got Amen. Yep. Last week, I think I mentioned that he was my favorite on this program. I said, he's my favorite. He checks off more boxes than Draymond, Evan Mobley. And this is a guy who's the only player in the NBA top 20 in both blocks and steals. The versatility you talked about, where he's a point of attack, shut down Steph Curry the other night. And he's been doing that all season, is that when you got a Ja Morant or a Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Jalen Brunson, whomever it is, he's the guy that they're going to throw at him to completely throw off all their first actions. And that is a thing that you can't say for Evan Mobley or Draymond Green. Draymond Green's greatest attribute in this conversation is that he has a podcast. I'm telling you, dude, he went from 0% chance, like it was 0.8% on Polymarket, 0.8% chance of winning Defensive Player of the Year, until he had that comment where he's like, I deserve it, 1,000% have a case for Defensive Player of the Year. And then he became the favorite. Yes, he had a great game against Giannis and the Milwaukee Bucks, and that helped kind of drive that conversation. But the greatest thing that that Draymond Green has going for him this year is that he is vocal and he has his podcast, and he started that narrative and started the campaign by himself. And I'm sorry, when you look at the defensive rating of Amen Thompson, it's 107 when he's on the floor. Look at the other defenders on Houston. You can say Dylan Brooks and Tari Eason, but I'm telling you, the Houston Rockets have a top four defensive rating this season with Alper and Şengün and Fred VanVleet on the floor for most of them. Who picked Houston as being a top four defensive rating team this season? Who picked it? No one did. You know why? Because they didn't see how good Amen Thompson would be as a 22-year-old in his second year in the league, dominating defensively and turning Stephen Curry into just another guy out there. He's been top 20 in both steals and blocks, only player to do that. His on-court defensive rating, 107, meaning the Houston Rockets are holding opponents to 107 points every 100 possessions when he's on the floor. That's better than Draymond's, that's better than Mobley's, and that's better than Jaren Jackson Jr.'s. And I would argue that those other three candidates, Jaren Jackson Jr., Draymond, and Mobley, have better defenders around them that can pump up that score, pump down in the case of a defensive rating where lower is better. Amen Thompson, best defensive player this year. And I would go Evan Mobley at number two. Tamani Kamara at number three, and Dyson Daniels right behind him. I think Tamani Kamara, second in the NBA in defensive stops, being a rim protector in ways that Dyson Daniels isn't. I would argue that he's been more impactful. And if you look at the defensive rating of the Portland Trailblazers over the last half of the season, he has been outstanding. We had him on the Big Number podcast. I don't know if you saw that interview, but Dan Devine and I had Tamani Kamara on the pod, and it was awesome. It was great to hear him talk about his game and how he prepares as a defender. He's the only guy in the NBA who has defended both SGA for more than 50 possessions and Nikola Jokic for more than 50 possessions. So the versatility and the ability to not just steal the ball and disrupt your first action, but also to be the back line of defense blocking shots. You watch that Paolo Banchero play and all the charges that he's taken. I think he gets the edge for me at number three. But hey, I can't argue with Lu Dort there. Can't argue with Dyson Daniels. I just think that Draymond Green, he's been a good defender, not a great one. And by the way, I think this is right. I don't even think he's eligible right now. Draymond Green still has another game that he has to play in order to be eligible for Defensive Player of the Year, which throws me off. I'm like, dude, if he turns his ankle in the first minute of the game on Friday night, all these sports books that have him as the favorite, they're going to look very dumb because he's not even eligible right now.
Yeah, he currently has 66 games played. However, he has three games under 20 minutes played. Actually, no. Yes, he is eligible. He's eligible. Okay, so he has 63 games of over 20 minutes played, and he has two games between 15 and 20 minutes. So he has reached the threshold. He's reached.
So if you have 15 to 20, you can have one. I thought it was just, you can have two of them.
Two.
Draymond.
He is officially
eligible.
Sorry,
I'm not as good at podcasting as you are.
He's like, shut your big eye. Shut your third eye, Tom. Put away your numbers.
It is confusing. Because then there's like, you can do like an injury, like exception, file for like an injury exception if you fall short. There's weird things. But the point is
I'm in favor of the rule. I'm in favor of the rule, Tom, for what it's worth. But like, there's all these little weird qualifiers. It makes it too complicated. Can we just have it easy? 65 games, period. End of story. Like, what is all this stuff about 15 to 20 minutes, this and that? Like, just make it 65 games, period. And that's it. That's all.
Well,
Ty Jerome being eligible for sixth man of the year, but not for most improved player. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
No, it doesn't. And I'll just throw this out there. Another reason why I got Amen Thompson is because he's played 280 more than Draymond Green, and that counts for something, yeah, right, Kev?
It does. Yep, it does, for sure. And that played into my decision with first-team All-NBA. I have Amen Thompson, Evan Mobley, Lu Dort. I also have Jalen Williams, and I have Dyson Daniels in the first team. So going to the second team, I do have your guy, Tom. I've got Tumani Kamara on my second team, all defense, alongside Draymond Green, Jaren Jackson Jr., Ivica Zubac, and OG Anunoby. But Tumani Kamara, the Blazers sent this Tumani Kamara, Defensive Player of the Year. Like, a lot of the teams send stuff, and Tumani Kamara, they sent this. I'm going to give one away to a Blazers fan, because within here, for this Defensive Player of the Year.
While you do that, I will explain. There's a box, and the reason why it's a box is because Tumani Kamara, that's his gesture. When he puts when he stops a guy defensively, he puts his hand gesture, he does the box out there, because he's putting the other scorer in a box. He's a guy that, when you look at his defensive stops, he's combined steals, blocks recovered, his offensive fouls drawn, he is second in the NBA behind Dyson Daniels. But you have to put in his number, 033, in order to open up that box. And what do you got in there? Show the people what
waffles.
You got.
You make waffles. You can make a Tumani Kamara waffle. So if you're a Blazers fan who wants to make Tumani Kamara edition box waffles, just respond to the post for this podcast on X. Just say 033 in response, and I'll randomly select a winner before the before ballots close on, I think that'll be Monday. I'll select a winner at random to receive Tumani Kamara, Defensive Player of the Year, NBA award voting recruitment, trying to sway me. They didn't sway me for second team, though. I already had him second team because he's been awesome, Tom, as you outlined earlier. Kamara's been absolutely unfreaking believable this year for the Blazers.
I love watching
and I feel it. And doesn't it feel like him overall as a player, that Kamara, we already know what he is defensively, but offensively, like, there's another level for him that he can reach over time with just how versatile he is and the number of different things he can do. I think this guy's got a chance to be like a really, real, like top 40, top 50 player in the NBA once he's at his peak. So yeah, I'm excited about Kamara. I want to talk a little bit about Draymond being on second team, because I think some people are going to vote him to win. And, you know, I would say Draymond has been defensive player of the year caliber starting February 8th. The last 29 games of the season, he's been unbelievable. Opponents are shooting 10.3% worse on two-pointers when Draymond is nearby since February 8th. But prior to that, they were only 5% worse, which is still good, but it's not defensive player of the year level. It was barely even all defensive level in the middle of the season when the Warriors traded for Jimmy Butler and decided, hey, let's start trying. Steph got better then. Draymond got better then. But ultimately, this is a full season award. It is not a lifetime achievement award either. It's just not. And so Draymond, he deserves second team All-NBA in my opinion, but I don't have him in the top three for defensive player of the year because it's not a full season award. And, you know, if he had played the way he did in the first half of the year, the remainder of the season, he may not even have been on the second team. It might have been a guy like Jason Tatum or Jaden McDaniels or Gobert or Caruso as a third OKC guy. It might have been Dylan Brooks or Derek White. Like a lot of these guys would have been in consideration. But for Draymond, you know, I thought he had an amazing second half of the year. It's one of the reasons why the Warriors feel real. But you got to count in the first half of the year. You can't forget October, November, December, January just because a guy's been awesome recently. You think that's fair, Tom? Like, I think with all these awards to kind of have that mindset, you can't just weigh the second half of the year. It feels like recency bias to me.
Yeah, and let's just call it out for what it is. This was Victor Wembanyama's award. And I would venture to guess that if there was no 65-game rule, I think you might see people in a sympathetic way be like, dude, that guy was the best defender of the year by far while he was on the floor. And considering that a lot of these guys are barely getting to 65 games in the first place, you might see people be like, you know what? Because of the huge margin and the substantial gap between Victor Wembanyama and the rest of the league defensively, and you see what the San Antonio Spurs have done defensively since he's been out, that you might see people vote for Victor Wembanyama. So in many ways, I feel like this is kind of the consolation award. And I know Draymond Green has deserved to get more than one, but when you look at the full season, like you said, the full of the season. This is not the best since Wemby went down. This is not the best since the Jimmy Butler trade. This is not the best since the last 10 years. This is about 82 games, who was the best defender, and Amen Thompson, in my book, has been the best defender, and I would venture to say if there was no 65-game rule, Victor Wembanyama might have won this whole thing.
I'm with you there, Tom. And, you know, on the note of Draymond deserving more, maybe, like, he's a generational defender. But like, it's a regular season award, and he's partially a generational defender because of what he does in the playoffs. And that's why I think there should be playoff awards, not just finals MVP, like the defensive player of the playoffs. Like, Draymond Green might have six of those, you know? Like, to me, that's something that is missed in the postseason, to give out awards for the best defender of the full playoffs, the best scorer, the best offensive player of the full playoffs and the finals MVP, all of these types of things. I would really love to see the NBA installed. If you're going to have a clutch player of the award, you can't have that for the playoffs. I mean, come on. Let me ask you this.
Kev, let me ask you this. Do you think Draymond would trade his rings for Rudy Gobert's four defensive player of the years? No,
he's not.
Not a chance. You know,
Rudy would trade all of them for one ring. All of them.
All of them, right? And you know in Mad Men when Don Draper is talking to Elizabeth Moss and he's like screaming at her.
I never watched the show.
Okay. I'll just say it.
It's on my list for someday.
She wants more recognition. She wants more praise. And Don Draper screams at her and says, that's what the money's for. And in the same way, for Rudy Gobert and all his Defensive Player of the Year awards and Draymond feeling like he deserves more, that's what the rings are for. That's what the banners are for. Like, you can't have everything. And if you are going to trade You know, if you want more Defensive Player of the Year awards in the regular season, okay. But I'm just saying, Draymond Green, you've got all the rings. You've got all that notoriety about your defensive play in the 16 wins of the postseason. That's fine. That's what you play for championships for. And Rudy Gobert would trade all of those for just one ring, like you said. And so I think Draymond's right. He might deserve more Defensive Player of the Year awards based on the entirety of the season, if you include postseason. But that's not what the rule is. That's not what the award is. And I feel like that's what the rings are for Draymond. You can sleep at night with those rings. It might not be super comfortable, but I would imagine you sleep better at night because of those rings than if you didn't have any of those.
Spot on, Tom. Let's take one last quick break, and then we're going to talk about the remainder of the awards. All right, Tom, sixth man of the year. I got number three on my ballot here, Ty Jerome from Cleveland. Number two, Malik Beasley. And then Peyton Pritchard winning sixth man of the year for the Boston Celtics. Pritchard has been outstanding this year. I mean, I think Beasley is deserving. He's the better three-point shooter, the better high-volume shooter. But Peyton Pritchard is outstanding in his own way as well. Shot 40.6% from three on 7.8 attempts per game. Beasley took a couple more per game, 9.3 per game, 41.2%. But Pritchard did way more as a playmaker, a better rebounder, better defender, better creator, self-created more of those shot opportunities, energizer off the Celtics bench, almost 30 points per game. Close between them. Beasley very deserving, but I gave Pritchard the nod here for this award.
I think the more that you start, the less I'm going to consider you for the sixth man of the year. Malik Beasley had 18 starts to pump up a little bit of his stats and kind of more of a starter than Peyton Pritchard, who only started two games this season. I'm dabbling with the take that if you start any games, you're ineligible for the sixth man of the year. It is kind of weird that we're giving an award for the best player who's not good enough to start games for you. It is kind of weird. It is strange that we have this award in the first place, and I get it. They want awards for not just the top players. We want guys who get recognized in the middle of the league.
Why not reward this? Six men are important. Manu Ginobili, Kevin McHale. There's been some great six men in NBA history, Hall of Famers. Sometimes you don't have to be a middling player. You can be a great player who comes off the bench. I think the award comes from a good place for that reason.
It does. It does. So zero starts. That's the bar. that's my take that you cannot starting. I know there's a limit to how many games you can start, but it's Malik Beasley.
That's what it is, which is a lot. Half is a lot.
It's a lot, dude. And Peyton Pritchard, He's my pick too. Ty Jerome, Malik Beasley in the conversation as well. DeAndre Hunter also deserves recognition. Part of the reason why they pulled him from the starting lineup this year was maybe Hunter wanted the Sixth Man of the Year award, and maybe they felt like we want to make sure that he is eligible. But that is Peyton Pritchard's award. Open and shut case. And he, for the majority of the season, didn't start any games. And then, of course, he starts against the Portland Trail Blazers, and he dropped a 40 piece next to Derek White. So he didn't quite make the Haberstroh rule of zero games started for six man. But if we're going to give a six man of the year award, you have to be six man for the entire year.
So, okay, let's talk about that for a minute. I'm very curious what the listeners think of this take, because I think there's something there. Currently, the NBA rule is you have to come off the bench for over half of your games. To me, that threshold is too high. Beasley, I think, is closer to where the borderline should be. He started 18 of 80 games, so that is 22.5% of his games played as a starter. If you set the threshold to 25% or 20%, to me, that feels a bit more realistic, Tom. It slices it in half. You want 0 games? You want 0% started? The NBA says less than 50. So how about 20 or 25?
Why don't we do a best part-time starter award? Because that's what Malik Beasley would be. Let's do it. Why not? If we're good for a full-time bench score, like, why don't we just do a part-time starter award. No, we wouldn't do that, but that's Malik Beasley. He started 18 games this year. I don't know why this is the hill that I want to die on, but Peyton Pritchard is the most pure bench player in the NBA. Most pure reserve. Most pure sixth man of the year because he's only started two games. So
yeah.
Hats off to Malik Beasley. Great shooter. Amazing player off the bench for the majority of the season. But if you're starting 18 games, I'm sorry. You're off my ballot.
Yeah. I actually thought Pritchard was an easy, like a pretty easy overall choice. Like Beasley's deserving, but Pritchard, everything he does for Boston, dude's awesome. Let's move on to Coach of the Year. I got Kenny Atkinson from the Cleveland Cavaliers winning this one. No big surprise considering their massive improvement this season. To me, some of the tougher choices were the second and third slot, because this year there's a lot of coaches you can make arguments for. Mark Daigneault from OKC, JB Bickerstaff with the Pistons improvement. Rick Carlisle, I feel like, has been way overlooked in this for the Pacers. You could say JJ Redick, Ty Lue, and Ime Udoka ended up getting my second and third slots for Coach of the Year with Kenny Atkinson winning it. Ty Lue, Kawhi Leonard plays less than half the season. Powell misses a ton of time. Roster gets shuffled mid-year with a trade for Bogey. They have the number three defensive rating. He helped them stay afloat offensively without Kawhi Leonard. And ever since they got Kawhi back, they have been absolutely stellar with Kawhi on the floor. I think he is deserving a second. And then with Udoka, they had one little blip, a six-game losing streak in the middle of January to February. They're 32-14 before that, 20-8 since. I thought he helped this team develop their identity. You mentioned how they're number three in defensive rating for the full season, Tom. Udoka is part of the reason why, with the scheme he installed, but also the mentality he has on the floor and the tone he sets as a coach for his team. And everybody falls in line with that. And Udoka, to me, is the third slot ahead of some of those other guys. I mean, I think Pistons fans are going to be pissed at me, especially after having Beasley second. But I couldn't go with JB because the Pistons were 7-18 this year against teams with a top 10 net rating. 7-18 against teams with a top 10 net rating. They weren't great against the best teams in the league. They really beat up on the weaker teams in the East, some of the middling teams. They were very good. They deserve all their praise. But for top three coach of the year with, I think, a loaded year, I just gave the edge to Udoka as the two seed. I gave the edge to Lue as a seed in the West, and Kenny Atkinson for overhauling that Cleveland Cavaliers team. Is that fair, Tom?
I have JB at number two behind okay. Kenny Atkinson. I have Daigneault at number three. So you mentioned it. It's going to be really tough to sort out two through like eight on this ballot. If you were going to do a top eight coach of the year candidates, you could probably fill any of those eight in any order and you can make a case for it, right? Like the thing about JB Bickerstaff, it's so funny, is that Kenny Atkinson might win the award because of how disappointing the Cavs were last year under JB Bickerstaff. So it's this weird dynamic where if you're voting Kenny Atkinson, you're almost saying that JB Bickerstaff did such a poor job last year with this talent, and Kenny has done such a great job unlocking Evan Mobley, getting Ty Jerome to be sixth man of the year candidate, getting Donovan Mitchell and Darius Garland playing like you're not worried about them taking turns, and then Jared Allen, of course, being as dynamic as a playmaker, not just a rim protector and finisher. It's been an awesome team to watch. I think it's harder. The marginal value of a win is so much greater at the 50-60 rather than the 20-30 or 20-40. I think that it's so much harder to be a team that is a plus 10 net rating in the NBA, one of the best net ratings we've ever seen in the NBA, the Cleveland Cavaliers this season. That's way harder to do on a night-to-night basis than, say, moving from one of the basement dwellers to a 45 win team. And look, this is a bad argument to make that JB Bickerstaff doesn't deserve Coach of the Year after what they did to the New York Knicks on Thursday night. But I would say this is a full season award, and Kenny Atkinson, with the expectations coming into this year and where they are now, no one has moved the needle in the title conversation more than Kenny Atkinson. I did not have them as a title contender, period, coming into this year. And they are in that top tier and have been there for months. And KOC, Mark Daigneault, it is insane that he's going to probably, I don't think he's going to finish in the top three this year. I don't think he's going to. And I think that's insane considering this team has the best point differential in NBA history.
Yeah. And they've dealt with absences in the year too. No Chet for a portion, no Hartenstein to begin the year. It's like they've had absences as well. So, I mean, it's pretty remarkable that they've been able to be this amazing defensively and this amazing offensively. It's not just SGA, it's Daigneault as well with that. Like it feels like anytime Usman Jang is on the court, he's playing well. I mean, like from a player development perspective
Williams,
as well.
The other Jalen Williams has triple doubles. Jalen Williams. Like, this team is so well coached, man. I can't wait to see what they do in the postseason, dude.
Me too. So I got Pistons fans really mad at me right now for JB Bickerstaff, not in my top three in coach of the year. Malik Beasley at number two for sixth man of the year. Most improved. Everybody's talking about Cade Cunningham. Who do you have for most improved, Tom?
Oh, I'm curious. I'm wondering if you're going to do this. You're not going to give JB Bickerstaff coach of the year top three. You're not going to go Malik Beasley. Are you going to go 3 for 3, the hat trick, by basically being public enemy number one in Detroit and not give it to Cade Cunningham? Because me, I got Dyson Daniels as my most improved. If it's not Ty Jerome. Now, you said it earlier. Ty Jerome not being eligible for most improved when he was basically out of the league last year, injured and also not playing, deserving of being like a rotation player. And then being arguably a top four player on a Cavs team that's winning about as high as we could have expected for the Cleveland Cavaliers, hitting the 100th percentile in expectation this year, that Ty Jerome is not eligible for most improved player is so asinine to me. It makes no sense. This guy has been awesome. But if he does not qualify and meet the criteria because of the weird, convoluted way that we do the end of year awards, I'll give it to Dyson Daniels, who, again, like the improvement from not really a rotation guy to being possibly the defensive player of the year is a huge change. And I want to give Dyson Daniels the credit here. So he's my pick for most improved if it's not going to Ty Jerome.
Yeah. I mean, so Dyson Daniels is deserving for sure. I had him second on my ballot. I had Christian Brown from the Denver Nuggets third on my ballot. I feel like he's been way overlooked in this whole discussion with his massive improvement offensively, huge uptick in volume and an improvement in efficiency as well. But I have Cade Cunningham winning the award. I got Cade winning most improved. And I know a lot of people are like, oh, the number one pick shouldn't be eligible. They're supposed to be really good. Well, last time we saw Cade healthy, it was like, he's all right. He's good. He's solid, but he's not number one pick expectations. He's a solid player. He's maybe the 80th best guy in the NBA, the 100th best guy in the NBA, and he goes to an all NBA level. You talk about the leap it takes to go from 40 wins to 60 wins versus 20 wins to 30 wins or 40 wins. Cade went from, is this guy a bust? Or to, oh, wait a minute, he's an all NBA talent. To me, I don't care where the guy was drafted. I care what they were last time we saw them to what they are today. And Cade Cunningham's improvement as a playmaker, as a scorer, as a shooter, consistency as a defender. He took a massive leap that's hard to make from okay, solid, high-volume player to all-NBA guy who some people might have on fifth on their MVP ballots and should be on most all-NBA ballots. To me, that's the biggest leap of anybody in this year's league, despite Dyson Daniels, despite Christian Brown, despite a fair amount of guys, Zubats, Austin Reeves, your guy Denny Avdia, a lot of candidates, Ty Jerome, who was not eligible, unfortunately. I've got Cade number one because I don't factor in where the guy was drafted necessarily, Tom. To me, it's about year-to-year improvement.
I can't get behind this. I can't. Cade
Cunningham. Really, you look really disappointed in me.
I am, dude. You want me to get
knocks on the door and phone calls from Detroit. That's what you want. You were hoping for it. But look, it's true, man. I voted for guys like this in the past before. It's not just an award for like, you know, borderline role player to really good role player, you know?
Yeah, last year, Cade Cunningham, 22.7 points per game, 7.5 assists per game. He shot 45% from the floor, 36% from three-point land, and 87% from the line. You're telling me that improvement from 23-8-4 to what he is this season is more impressive to you than what Dyson Daniels has done, or that Christian Brown has done, or that Ty Jerome has done. It's Tom, like, the guy was really good last year. He was really good this year.
It's not just a numbers thing, though. It's just not. To me, that's part of it. It's not just a numbers thing. Dyson Daniels is a great defender for the Pelicans as well. He was an awesome defender for the Pelicans. Dyson Daniels, the argument for me is like, oh, wait, how much he improved offensively?
Offensively,
yeah. Daniels has improved. But Cade Cunningham, the volume, the increase in minutes, the increase in responsibility, the improvement as a playmaker, to me, Cade took a big leap from solid, you know, the solid number three guy or number four guy on a title team to a potential one or two on a championship team. More likely a number two than a number one, for what it's worth.
Kev, all right, then say it here. The reason why you have Cade Cunningham as most improved player of the year in 2025 is because you thought he was a massive bust last year.
Yeah, I thought he looked like a bust. I thought he looked like an okay, you know, solid player, but maybe somebody the Pistons should consider trading. I worried about what he was for that team. I worried that defensively he was too inconsistent. I worried that his efficiency as a perimeter scorer was never going to reach the level that it needed to. But for Cade this year, he answered a lot of my concerns. And he still has more ways to improve as well over the course of time. That's what's, I think, promising for the Pistons, that Cade has more improvable areas as he continues to develop. But this improvement from year three to year four, to me, was most improved pick worthy. Now, it's different perspectives. Most improved is always gets into these types of debates. It's always like this. Remember when Ja Morant won it? And I think that year I might have voted Desmond Bain, if I remember correctly. I may be misremembering. Might have been different years. But like Ja, number two pick, it was the same thing then. Well, should he really be a candidate for this? It's always like role player versus top pick for this debate. And maybe the NBA needs to make a rule. You have the 65-game rule. You have this rule for half games for six man. Maybe you can't be a top five pick or a top three pick and be eligible for most improved player. Maybe the NBA needs a rule for this as well.
I don't know what the rule change would be. But I appreciate you standing on your take, because I think for people who are arguing for Cade Cunningham to be the number one guy in the most improved race, you are admitting that you thought he was a massive bust, because there's no other argument. There's no other argument that a number one overall deserves most improved player of the year.
Not bust at like the Markelle Fultz type of level, but bust to number one pick expectations. This was my same thing I said earlier in the year with Ricochet. He might be a bust if the three-pointer actually isn't going to come along. Like, he needs to be able to shoot the three. Well, he's shooting the three, and he looks like a really good role player for 10-plus years, and maybe more than that, considering his range of skills. With Cade last year, it was like, well, yeah, he can score inefficiently, high volume, good stats, bad team player. I'm not so sure he's actually that great. And I think you look at player rankings, nobody would really have him in the top 70 or top 80. He was a borderline top 100 guy for the Pistons through the first 3 years of his career. But now at this point, he's an all-NBA guy, like for sure all-NBA guy, as part of a really good Pistons defense, part of the reason why they had the big improvement. That's why I voted Cade.
Yeah, I feel like maybe
I was too low on him before. Maybe that's what you're saying, right?
Well, no, I'm just saying that implicitly what you're arguing, or anyone who picks Cade Cunningham here, is that he was not nearly as good as you thought he was, because he's not an MVP candidate. Like, you're not like SGA, Jokic, or Cade Cunningham, because in my book, that's the leap you would have to make. For Cade Cunningham, who averaged 23-8 last year, and his three-point percentage has not improved, his field goal percentages have improved a little bit, his all-in-one metrics have improved a little bit. I'm not saying he has not improved, but what I'm arguing is, considering how good he was last year, in order for me to put him atop this race, it would be, is he an MVP this year? Is he the best player in the league this year? And that jump, I think, would be requisite for me to be number one overall in this race. But to me, Dyson Daniels is two-way play. The fact that he is leading the league by far in the steals column is, to me, the most improved player if we're not doing Ty Jerome. Now, I don't think there should be an ideological rule change where it's like guys can't win it in their second year, or guys can't win it in their third year, or guys can't win it if they're the number one overall pick. I do think that voters will incorporate all of that already in the same way. I don't think we need a 65 game rule, because I think voters already implicitly are measuring players against how many games played. And you see it in the numbers. The star players this year are not playing as much as they did last year. But there is some evidence that the 65 game rule is working, because two seasons ago, before the rule was implemented, the star player participation was lower than it was over the last 2 years. And I would say it has worked on that level, that you saw teams shut down a lot of these guys in the second half of the year. And especially the play-in tournament has done a lot to improve player participation. But I would still say that I can't get behind Cade Cunningham, because what you're saying is, and you've already stood on it, is that he was a disappointment up until this year. And a number one pick who's averaging 23 points a game already, to get this award, to me, the bar has to be higher.
Very fair. And I think you're going to have a lot of people making that argument. And I look forward to seeing who actually ends up winning this, because there's a lot of people who are going to share your perspective. There's a lot of people who are going to say his improvement as a volume shooter off the catch, the fact he began extending his range to three off the dribble, he improved at the rim, he improved as a defender. There will be people who say, well, he took enough of a leap to All-NBA. There will be that argument. There will be people who say number one picks should not be considered, period, end of story. But to me, I think, you know, JB rightfully deserves a ton of the credit for the Pistons' improvement this year. Malik Beasley deserves a lot of the credit for the Pistons' improvement. Tobias Harris and these veteran additions, Beasley, all this, right? They changed the team, but the young guys, those core pieces as well. Jalen Duren got better in the second half of the year. And Cade Cunningham, if you're ranking the reasons the Pistons got better, Cade Cunningham is number one on the list. Why the Pistons became a top six seed in the Eastern Conference. He's number one on the list, in my opinion.
I think Trajan Langdon in the front office deserves some credit too. Malik Beasley and Tobias Harris have been awesome in spreading the floor and surrounding mm-hmm. him with shooters. And Jalen Duren and Stu starting at the five, like they were playing at the five and not having double big lineups a lot this season, which is what Monty Williams did, where it was like they were playing 90s basketball, like caveman basketball, with two like throwback centers on the floor at all times next to Cade Cunningham. Didn't work. And what JB Bickerstaff and the front office did to space the floor with Malik Beasley and Tobias Harris, I think opened up the floodgates for Cade Cunningham. And I think he's been improved, but I think the system has improved just as much as Cade Cunningham. And to me, the improvement is more about the coaching and the personnel than it is about Cade Cunningham. And that might make me an enemy in Detroit, but I'm saying everybody we'll deserves enemies, credit here.
Both of us.
Yeah.
We'll both be enemies of Detroit. I look forward to seeing how that season closes out for them. The Pistons and Bucks play twice to close the year. There's still, if the Pistons win both of those games, they'll be the 5 seed instead of the 6 seed. Milwaukee is on a little bit of a winning streak here, 6 in a row. Good vibes in Milwaukee right now, but we'll see. Who knows? Maybe Detroit rattles off 2 in a row and steals the 5 seed from the Bucks. Tom, this is fun, man. This is fun. We had some surprising agreements, some good disagreements. I'm happy with both of our ballots. I'm very happy.
For people, a little peek behind the curtain, you would not share me your ballot. I was getting prepped for this pod, and you were like, nah, nope. I'm putting Tom on the blocked list. You blocked me from the document. And you know what? I think that's for better content. You're a great, great host, but also a better producer. Good job, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. Saw on the doc last night, I just blocked Tom Avastro's email.
Did you think about, all right, I'm going to ask you honestly. I want your honest, like fully transparent. Did your Cade Cunningham vote have anything to do with your Coach of the Year award vote or your Sixth Man of the Year award?
In the sense that I'm crediting Cade more than JB Bickerstaff, yes. Because I do not have JB in my top three. And I think a lot of people are going to have him in their top three. I just favored some of the other coaches, and JB deserves a lot of the credit. So does the front office, as you said. But in my assessment of the team, I think Cade deserves the most credit for his improvement. But, you know, There'll be a lot of disagreement there with most improved. I can't wait to see how this vote shakes out. I think we know some of the results. We know in all likelihood because of the spoiler ballots that Bontemps does with the straw poll, big spoilers, that SGA probably wins MVP. But other than that, this could be really contested. Defensive player of the year will be contested. I think rookie of the year will be Castle, and we'll see about Risa though. But other than that, I don't know. I don't know. Like, there could be a lot of surprises, Tom. I can't wait, man.
I submitted yesterday for Yahoo. I submitted what I think will happen in the ballot. So I think I'm going to remember this correctly. I think my prediction is Shea's going to win MVP. My prediction is that Draymond's going to win Defensive Player of the Year. My prediction is going to be that Sixth Man of the Year goes to Pritchard. Coach of the Year goes to Atkinson. Most Improved is going to go to Dyson Daniels. And what was the other one I might be missing here? I think I got them all there. Clutch Player of the Year, Jalen Brunson. I think Jalen Brunson.
Yeah, I think
that's that's my prediction of how it will go. But as you saw on the ballot in the past hour of this pod, I have some controversial opinions on this, but I do think that the one that I'm most looking forward to seeing and how it all shakes out is Defensive Player of the Year, because that one, man, that is juicy. And I think Evan Mobley and Dyson Daniels, the biggest reason that, and Amen Thompson, the biggest reason why they don't have more of a campaign going is because they don't have a platform like Draymond Green on his podcast. That's my hot take.
Tom, thank you for joining me today, man. Appreciate it.
You got it, Kev.
And a big thank you to Mike, Emmy, and everybody else on that document that Tom was not on for producing today's episode. Thank you all very much. Thank you for listening as well. We'll be back again next week. We have three shows. We're doing a Monday show, Wednesday show, and a Friday show because it's play-in week. It's playoff preview week. So big week ahead. Be sure to subscribe on the audio feeds if you have not done that already. And also, keep tabs on Yahoo's YouTube page as well. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.